It's mainly a series of questionnaires that we issue and deals with some of their private lives and this sort of thing. Should this information be divulged in the raw sense, again, you would jeopardize that kind of a program and the privacy of those people. And we would not only be able to do that one time, I'm sure. We also have a considerable amount of collaborative research with industry. At Oregon State University, at this time, it amounts to about $5 million a year. In order to work with industry, and of course we all realize that industry is here to make a profit and to get an edge on the market, there is frequently an exchange of proprietary information, particularly from the company into the institution as it begins to carry out its research. We are by contract bound not to divulge that information. However, our faculty are still bound to publish. If, however, that data were giving up ahead of time, before publication, in release to a Public Information Act or something of that nature, you would imagine that industry would no longer collaborate with any of our institutions. What we do in the sense of holding on to data is that we will deter the publication of a paper, perhaps 3, maximum 6 months, in order to seek a patent where one is appropriate. And that's the extent of withholding information from the public. Years ago, I was concerned with my own program when I'm an oceanographer, I came on the beach, and I had been warned ahead of time that a private citizen wanted copies of all my records within hours that they had been taken. I probably would have scuttled them over the side, and that would have meant at least $500,000 thrown away. That sort of thing scares us from time to time. Right now, the greatest scare that we have is when people call and want to request copies of proposals that our faculty members have made, particularly in dealing with the protocols of using laboratory animals. And thus far, we have not released that types of information. Proposals are those things that are made ahead of being funded. Once things are funded, they become public record, and then they are allowed to be public. But even the National Science Foundation will not release proposals because those are concepts put forth by the people themselves. And so we propose here this amendment to the current bill. My feeling is that the current bill, which talks about research notes, are ill-defined. And we propose the wording that you have before you, where we use the word writings, which is a well-defined term already in ORS, as a point of reference. And that would help secure the assurances that we need to continue the work that we have going in research. For the record, I'd like to insert a journal item, article from 1983-84 from the Journal of College and University Law that discusses this issue in some depth and discusses a law that was put forth in the state of Virginia to deal just with the issues that I'm talking about here. Thank you.
Any questions? All right. Thank you for being here. We have no further witnesses on Senate Bill 219, so we'll
call.
Council?
Yes, I'd like to call the members' attention to a letter from the head of the Information Services Division for the City of Eugene, speaking to the proposed provision about computer programs and setting forth why they think that's a useful provision.
I tell you, one thing that I would like to see in some session someday is somebody who's willing to take ORS 192.500 and break it down in pieces so that every time you change a punctuation mark, you don't have to have 3 pages of bill to do it. Ungodly long and unwieldy section of the code. Any Senator Hamby?
I'd like to ask Council if the proposed amendment proposed by higher ed might not also include a syllabus or coursework in connection with study. It could well, could have not. I mean, it's so terribly broad. But
I would have to think about that, but I think you can make an argument about that, yes.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. All right, let's, I want to go to a work session on Senate Bill 20. Oh, wait a minute now, hold it, stop, back up. We've got to change drivers here if I do that. What do we have, two more? We got two more? Okay, I think we'll take up Senate Bills 20 and 21 last, because I have to change counsel here and we have to stop the proceedings, and I don't want to do that. So let's go to let's go to Senate Bill 497. And after 497, we will go to 502, and then we'll go to 493. So, Senate Bill 497, and we don't have any witnesses signed up on that.
Mr. Chair, I can...
We do now. Okay. Come on up, Mr. Putnam. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Putman. I'm manager of recovery services for the Adult Family Service Division. Both of these bills are a product of a governor's commission on child support enforcement, which was active summer of last year, held public hearings throughout the state on the various problems associated with child support. One of the testimonies frequently given to that advisory commission was that the non-custodial parent, in trying to change visitation rights, frequently did not know where the custodial parent was and could not find out where she was, normally a woman, because the records of the agency are confidential. The commission drafted a rather simple bill which would allow such a parent in those circumstances to serve the agency. We in turn would send that service by certified mail with return receipt requested to our last known address, and that would constitute service. The bill before the committee goes beyond that, and I think does a couple of things which were not the intent of the commission, and I have not been able to determine why the drafting of the bill differs from that which the commission sent forward. However, the two points of difference are: first, the bill would limit our help to those cases that are actively receiving public assistance. However, the very circumstances that might want to cause a visitation order to be changed might be the reasons that cause the case to close. So I'm just saying, if we have the address, we would be glad to make a mailing to that last known address. Secondly, the bill also now requires that we provide service. The commission's intent was that we attempt service by mail. And there's a whopping difference between our trying through mail and shall provide service. So I would tell you that our agency supports the concept behind the legislation and ask that you consider substituting the wording put forth by the commission in lieu of the draft that was sent, that was actually filed. I had discussed that issue with Senator Cohn, who was a member of the commission. It was her advice to me that we allow the bill to be introduced as is and deal with the amendment before the committee.
I would agree. I agree with Mr. Putnam, Mr. Chairman. I think okay. I think the bill is a significant of enough of an issue that we ought to amend the bill and try to work on it and get it. Because it is really difficult for people to attempt to locate people. Not that they want to necessarily see them, but they need to make some kind of contact in the whole process. And I think it's useful if the agency is willing to do it, as he outlines, that we try to accommodate, make that accommodation.
All right. Any questions?
Is this adoptees?
What
primarily, what people? It's just in support enforcement area. No, doesn't deal with adoptees. It's the support enforcement issue, and if they want to change visitation, they want to do a summons to bring them in to change the visitation or anything. Sometimes the non-custodial parent has no way to locate, to even have served a summons to get them in to court because of the inability to find them. So it's not, you're asking them to pass on information to summons.
All right. Any other questions? Now, let's see now.
Yeah, we have, Mr. Kai, have a
yes, question. Senator Cohen, go ahead.
Would you then, the third page of your testimony is really your proposal for amending it that the agency, that you'd support and you think is reasonable?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, yes. That's the exact wording right out of the commission report.
Right.
No changes.
Yeah, I have no understanding why it got so mixed up in the legislative council because that was really what they...
Okay. All right, stay right there. Then I don't think there are any other witnesses on 497. So we'll go to Senate Bill 502.
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, I'm Keith Putman, Manager of Recovery Services for the Adult and Family Service Division. This, too, is a bill recommended by the Governor's Commission on Child Support. The concept of this bill is that there should be an advisory council to assist in the establishment of proper amounts for ordering of child support. And as you well know, this is an issue where dispassionate debate isn't commonplace, and trying to set up these kind of standards would be helped by a committee of this standing. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer one suggestion, which admittedly is not a major issue with us, but the bill asks that the committee meet at the call of the director of the Department of Human Resources. We would simply request that good management have you change that to the administrator of the Adult and Family Service Division. Just saves writing a few letters. I don't think it changes the concept or the result or outcome or anything else.
Any questions, Mr. Putnam? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brad Swank.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. The Judicial Department has taken no position on the concept or policy of the bill, but in our review of the bill, we noticed a practical concern that the committee may want to address if it decides to deal with this bill favorably. What we noticed is that while the bill establishes a committee to deal with creating standard support standards statewide, it doesn't provide for any staff for the committee or to say where the committee is to operate out of. As this committee knows, staff for a committee does all of those things like research, sets up meeting rooms, provides for the meetings, gets correspondence out, those sorts of things, and the bill is silent on who is to staff this. We felt, just for the committee's concern, it might be appropriate that the Department of Human Resources do the staffing on this bill because the Department of Human Resource is the one that calls these meetings and is basically responsible for it. We'd also like to note that in subsection 4 of section 1 of the bill, there's a requirement to disseminate information, and we thought we would mention, and that requirement is given to the State Court Administrator's Office. There are currently people in the Department of Human Resources who are not only involved in developing information on child care or child support standards, but in disseminating that kind of information, we thought it might be appropriate if the Department of Human Resources handled that responsibility, since they're already doing something similar, and it might create an expansion of their existing program, but it would be different than the State Court Administrator's Office, which has no experienced staff in the area and would have to establish a whole new program to do that.
Senator Cohen?
I think, Brad, the problem that was noted in the testimony, and again, this is one of the unfortunate situations. I hope we all learn by this. When we create commissions and then we cause them to come to the end of their lifetime in the middle of anything, and their all of their work and all the time spent with gathering public testimony comes down to the next legislative session with no one to either explain it or follow through on it. But that's an editorial comment for all of us to learn. The problem, as it was, people expressed concern, was that not only were the standards unclear or that they need to be more objective and needed to be developed, but that the judges didn't pay attention to them. And my guess is that's why you have the state court administrator, because they wanted that information to be disseminated more specifically to the people who were in fact utilizing in some degree, in some cases, those kinds of things. So I'm not objecting to the Department of Human Resources. It's just by way of description that part of the problem comes not just in the general public understanding of what the guidelines are or might be, but the judges and the people who are involved in the system.
Well, there, if I might, Mr. Chair, there are also people in the Department of Human Resources who establish support payments through their administrative process. And anyway, we thought we would raise these concerns because they were issues that the committee might want to consider when it looks at the bill.
Any further questions? Senator Wires.
On subsection 4, the last sentence, the reasons for departing from the standards must be given in a written statement accompanying any order for support in an amount substantially different from that of the objective standard. That is talking about an order that's made by a court as well as by ministry. That's going to, since judges don't prepare orders, lawyers do, that's going to be something where we're going to have to teach all the judges and then all the lawyers that they're going to have to be aware of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wires, we understand that there are some judges who do prepare their own orders in certain circumstances, and frankly the department has gotten mixed reviews from judges on the substance of the bill on how that would affect them. Some judges think the bill is great, others think that would create a problem for them, and the department hasn't taken a position on that.
Well, this bill would not only affect support enforcement cases, it would also affect decrees that contain support amounts.
Yes.
Doesn't it? I got a little problem with that particular provision. I might not have a problem with it if we had a little amendment there that said in cases where the district attorney is involved or something like that, where you've got a support enforcement activity going on. But if you've just got a standard divorce, that's going to be, I suppose, another grounds for malpractice. If somebody misses doing that and somebody comes back later and says their subsequent lawyer knows this statute and the previous lawyers didn't, say, well, gee, you didn't get as much child support as you should have, and not only that, the judge didn't require the lawyer to include that in the order, and one of the lawyers should have picked that up. And on the white rats theory around here, you know, the lawyers do tend to be very critical of each other's work, and particularly when they get a new client and they can second guess what the prior lawyer didn't do. And if we're trying to avoid creating more litigation, I think we ought to, if that's one of the goals of the session, then we ought to consider some other way to get this to be paid attention to other than mandating that it has to be included in every order, where there's a substantial deviation from the standards, I think.
No, I think there are some difficulties with implementation. Well, But it is a discussion area, which is probably more than what we want to deal with, at least today, or without
yeah.
any great
work. This is a laudable purpose overall, but maybe needs some fine-tuning or something.
I just think it's a problem that is of a major concern in the whole area of every session, at least not on this side this time, but we have the whole problems of rewriting the domestic relations code, and one of the things that causes a lot of trauma, a lot of difficulty in that whole setting of support originally. Fairness, the whole fairness issue is right, sort of boiled down right there.
Yeah, and it's good to have standards, I agree.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you. That will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 502. We'll go to Senate Bill 493. Senator Cohn, I've got Kathleen Haley and Elmer Kramer signed up. Who would you suggest testify first?
I'd rather have me do it first.
Okay.
Since I'm not sure what they're going to say, and I need to tell they're not. I'll tell you why now.
Okay.
They would probably, this is a surprise to them, not be the same. Mr. Chairman, colleagues, this Senate bill, I'm Joyce Cohen for the record, Clackamas County on Senate Bill 493. Senate Bill 493 came to my attention because of my interest along the way in following the Psychiatric Security Review Board, its operations, and my involvement in it since I served on the House side in reviewing its activities there on that Judiciary Committee. There, in 1986, there was a court ruling that came about that I think warrants discussion by the legislature this time on what if anything we ought to make in terms of changes which might impact on how they do their job and how they work with their charges or clients, or however you want to call them. Senate Bill 493 would make health care providers under contract with the Psychiatric Security Review Board agents of the state and thereby allow them to be covered by the Oregon Tort Claims Act. You'll see in the testimony it came about a Riken, let's see what it is, the case citing here, Kane v.S. Riken. It was a decision December 1985. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled that a community health care provider having accepted a mental health patient under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Review Board had a duty to supervise the patient's conduct for the protection of the general public. For this reason, Providence Medical Center was held liable for the death of James Kane. The court case was that Paul Riken, who was conditionally released and enrolled in the psychiatric daycare treatment program, was apparently a schizophrenic and was in a uncontrollable phase at that point. It went out and accidentally ran a red light, killed someone by the name of James Kane. The Oregon Tort Claims Act permits suits against every public body for its torts. Employees and agents acting within the scope of their employment or duties. In their contract with the State Mental Health Division, Providence is specified as an independent contractor and not an agent of the state. Providence argued, however, that they were acting on behalf of the Mental Health Division and were therefore, in fact, agents. Again, regarding the determination of the agency in this context, the court determined that because this issue was not fully developed at the trial level, they couldn't decide from the record whether there were facts relevant to the issue, and they couldn't decide it as a matter of law. And for this reason, the question of Providence's immunity was decided on the basis of a contract, and Providence was not granted immunity under the Tort Claims Act. Again, it is left to the legislature to clarify the statute and ensure that these health care providers are granted immunity. one of the ways to have done it was to just automatically declare them as having immunity, and I'm certainly not prepared to go that far, because I think there are times when we don't want to automatically give people immunity. With all due respect, though, I do think that the preserving the ability of the Psychiatric Review Board to function and to make sure that the people they contract within the community are willing to take their cases, it is worth our consideration to determine whether we want to extend that liability to include their contractors as agents of the state. There is an amendment, technically, providing that the state acting for the Mental Health Division as a contractor or subcontractor be added if we should move ahead with this bill. This deals primarily with who is, from an administrative standpoint, the agency that signs the contracts, and that is, in fact, the Mental Health Division. I bring this to you for your consideration as we move along and as we continue to be concerned that the Psychiatric Security Review Board specifically be continuing its activities to keep people in the community as best they can and to have full compliance with every kind of mental health provider that they can put within their grasp or willingness to participate. We do have a fiscal impact statement on this bill after going through some of the risk management, and it is $6,700, apparently, as best they can gather, to cover the clients of the Psychiatric Review Board who are out in the community in the mental health. And the agencies are here. I'm not sure what they're going to say, but it is here for your consideration. Thank you.
Questions, Senator Cohen?
Yeah. Yes. That $6,700, who gave it? Gave you that fiscal impact?
It's my understanding that someone in my office called the risk management group in General Services.
So what we'd be saying is we'd be hitting the ground somewhere between exempting these people from liability and the current law, which is that the providers are have to buy their own insurance as part of their contract, and they'd be repaid that through their contract with the state. That's what the current situation is, isn't it?
Yes, the current situation is that yes, in fact, they are. There was $1 million award in this case.
Be paid for by state. I guess I could ask the director of this. I guess I don't have a question. I guess I have a comment.
Well, actually,
we're just going to say that instead of a person being able to recover whatever cap we pass this session for non-economic damages, there'd be $100,000 the family of somebody who got killed by somebody who was under PSRB and out in a community program would be $100,000.
I think it's
economic or non-economic.
I think, you know, it is essentially that kind of a trade-off, and I'm here bringing this case to you, and I would command that you look, and I'll get copies of it if you're interested in all, and moving in looking further at this bill of the court case itself and see what you think about it. Again, it was brought to my attention by a constituent, and I think it's fair to bring it here because of the Psychiatric Review Board and its functions, and we do have some obligation to look at what that means to them as an agency.
Well, I'm a real supporter of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, but I don't know if I want to go back and tell my constituents that people who are on parole in a contractual program, families of the deceased would be limited to $100,000 recovery.
I'd have you look at the case. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? All right, thank you. Let's see. Elmer Kramer, please.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Elmer Kramer. I'm manager of community programs for mental and emotional disturbances for the Mental Health Division. The Mental Health Division supports the concept underlying the Senate Bill 493. And I think the reason that we use the word concept is because the providers of services to conditionally released psychiatric security review board clients in some ways are the same as providers who provide foster care services and group home services, for example, in the community. In other words, the division, as you know, contracts with community mental health programs, and the local community mental health program or county program can contract or subcontract with other providers. And by supporting the concept, we're really saying that we're very sensitive to the issue that we have difficulty recruiting providers not only for psychiatric security review board services, but also for foster.
With the persons who make a directive, in those situations, the physicians are directed to comply with the person's wishes or transfer the person to another physician or another facility who might comply with their wishes. Regarding Section 7, there has not been a definition provided for coma. In speaking with the members of the task force and in physicians, it became clear that coma is an accepted medical term. Other terms that were discussed, persistent vegetative state, state of permanent unconscious, are not accepted terms. By using the term coma, it is meant to exclude persons in a persistent vegetative state. The way that was explained to the committee in testimony, a person in a PVS state may appear to exert, may in fact exert some physical motions and may appear to have some conscious motion. Those persons would be excluded. They would not be within the definition of coma. In Section 11, relating to insurance practices, discrimination as applies to the setting of premiums has been added. So a person would not be able, could not be discriminated for having a directive or not having a directive in the issuance of insurance or the setting of rates. Section 12 is the section that governs the punishment for concealing, destroying, or altering directives. It is a Class A felony if someone does those acts with the intent and effect of causing the withholding. And as stated in Section 12, this withholding to make it a Class A felony must hasten the death of the declarant. As stated, it is unclear whether, if the death was not hastened, whether this would be an attempted crime. And what I suggested to the committee in the memo is that the committee may wish to establish a lesser crime where the withholding is intended and effected, but for one reason or another, death is not hastened by the action, or a prosecutor was not able to show a link between the withholding and the hastening of death. One additional major issue that was discussed in the testimony that is not reflected in these amendments is the issue of an exception for pregnant women. The task force members did not feel comfortable in recommending an amendment to this committee because there was no actual decision made by the task force during its deliberations. What I have given to the committee in the memo is an amendment that is derived from the Uniform Act, and it states that the directive of a qualified patient known to the attending physician to be pregnant must not be given effect as long as it is probable that the fetus could develop to the point of live birth with continued application of life-sustaining treatment. This same amendment could be applied to persons in Section 6 or a Section 7 category. Section 6 are persons who are incapacitated without a directive, and Section 7 are comatose. As to that particular amendment, I had asked Dr. Stemphal, who had testified in opposition to the bill, and that particular amendment satisfied his concerns as to this problem. An amendment like this or of this sort has been provided in most of the states that have living will laws.
All right. Now, Senator Riles, is it your preference that these amendments be adopted by this committee? All right. Anyway, does the committee want to discuss these amendments? What do you want to do with them?
Well, I guess I don't want to do anything differently. I do think that if, for my purposes, I'd like to include the pregnancy exemption just to have it printed in, included. That goes beyond the task force, Otherwise, I think we ought to have them printed and have people have a chance with them that they're too much changed. There's too much interest in the bill to not have it finally in some form that people can look at.
All right. Well, then Senator Cohn moves that amendments LC 19 be incorporated as a part of the bill, and the bill as amended be printed. Is there any discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wires.
Well, I'm not eager to rush into anything. Right after the hearing, I was urged not to move to table this during the hearing. I guess I was urged that between the first day and the second day of the hearing, and I didn't ask to move to table. I thought that would have been inconsiderate and harsh and so on. But I am concerned about, I haven't asked how many bills we have here, but large numbers are bandied about. We just had one bill that there's been a big struggle about. I don't have any necessary concern about the idea of printing a bill. I haven't really compared this draft carefully enough with Senate Bill 20 yet to know whether, but I do know that someone will say, if when we get that printed, now you've really got something that's very different, we need to have extensive additional hearings. Unless we're now going to just say, okay, now we're going to push this bill out. If we're going to do that, then we probably ought to start talking about it. It's my impression that this bill has a lot of people who are resisting it strongly, and it's always one solution just to shove the bill on out to the floor and let the floor make the decision. I don't know if I'm almost finished. That's not going to be something that's going to terribly upset me, but I know sometimes people in the full body want to know why the people in the committee didn't thrash it out. And if we're going to thrash it out, I suspect we'll need to reschedule this at least once or twice more. And that's what I want to say. I have some concerns.
My motion, or my, I think it certainly didn't include pushing it out on the floor or having additional hearings. I just think the staff is, we've had a lot of testimony. We've had people who offered suggestions in good faith. I think that it's, and you've had a group of people who worked on this issue, people who followed it and have been concerned and raised their concerns. And I think they ought to at least have some opportunity to look at something in print after all this, including the staff time invested. And that's my purpose. It is not to make any kind of judgments for anybody, to take any table at some time. If it ever gets raised again, I'm not really making any judgments at all about it. My purpose is just to allow them to get get in a printed form and to at least put in some form that people can request the amendments that have been suggested.
Further discussion on Senator Cohn's. Further discussion on Senator Cohn's motion. Senator Wires.
What would be the further advantage to having this printed? This this is a as far as our understanding of it, this is now a fully typed up new bill. Is the idea so it could be circulated as A, engrossed and to the public? Is that the advantage of getting it printed, or?
I would think so.
Mr. Chair.
I think you have a task force that's worked for 2 years on this, and I would give them a courtesy to allow them to at least have what they consider a final product that they want to either discuss with themselves or look at or hold in their hands or do whatever they want to do, and any member who is critical of it can also be criticized in or out or around this body without it being something other than what the amendments that are desired, and I'm willing to do that as a courtesy.
Senator Brennan?
I have strong objections to portions in the bill and portions of the amendments. You may have it printed if you like. The committee chooses. I just wish to be made that those opinions of mine known, I guess, in advance.
All right. Is there any objection to Senator Cohn's motion? All right, it's so ordered.
Could we still have it printed if we tabled it today? We've now passed that motion. It's going to be printed. I'm not necessarily all that eager to table it today. I guess what I'm trying to get at is we've now decided to print it, but it's my understanding this is a high priority by some people to pass this. It isn't that they just want to get it printed. And I don't know. I guess we can talk later about how much time we're going to spend on it. But
we've now spent 10 minutes more than was necessary. Right.
Well,
now.
But when are we going to have the discussion about the bill?
That's going to be a part of the chairman's job, I suppose, to decide whether this bill comes on for any further hearings or not. And I expect to utilize my responsibilities or pursue my responsibilities. Anything further on Senate Bill 20? All right.
Mr. Chairman,
Council.
The committee, just to clarify Senator Cohn's motion, did the motion include the replacement of the word without on
yes.
page 6, line 13?
Yeah.
And for further clarification, it did not include any language regarding a pregnancy exception.
It did
include that. Okay. And so to clarify the motion, the exception that's drafted on page 3 of my memo applies it to situations just because this was the language I chose to persons with directives. Is it the intent?
It's just fine.
I need to know whether it's the intent of the motion that this be applied to all, that is the exception applied to all persons, whether they have a directive or not.
Senator Cohn indicates in the affirmative. Is that everybody's understanding of it, the way she presented it? That, is there anybody who wants to raise any objection? All right. Then that's so ordered. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 20 and go to the work session on Senate Bill 21. Council.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, beginning on page 3 of the memo, I discussed briefly the changes that have been made in Senate Bill 21. We're now looking at Legislative Council Draft 204-2, dated April 1st, 1987. In Section 1, the definition of directive has been given the same definition as in Senate Bill 20. For the purposes of the record, the draft we're speaking of is Senate Bill, the draft 21-6, dated 4-1-87. Section 2 has made a change in requiring that the attorney in fact be a competent adult rather than any person. Section 3 of the bill requires that a power of attorney executed in this state meet the requirements of Section 3. Later on, the bill discusses that powers of attorney executed in other states are valid if they're valid in those other states. To address another objection raised in the testimony, the witnesses also must be adults. That's on page 3, line 18 of the bill. Section 5 of the bill reflects a change to give the principal the opportunity to withdraw if the person is in, if the principal is incapacitated. Under the printed bill, the principal, the attorney in fact, could not withdraw if the person was incapacitated. The amendment would give the attorney in fact the opportunity to withdraw by giving notice to the attending physician. Section 8 of the bill has been clarified to indicate clearly what the powers of the attorney in fact are. And the powers of the attorney in fact are the powers that the principal would have if the principal was not incapacitated. This means regardless of what this committee or any change in the law is with regard to the withdrawing of life-sustaining procedures, the attorney, in fact, would be limited to doing what the principal could do. And if the principal can't withdraw life-sustaining procedures in a particular situation, then neither could the attorney, in fact. On page 8, line 20 of the bill, we have added a section to relieve the attorney, in fact, from financial responsibility for the principal's health care costs. This was a suggestion made in the testimony, and this is consistent with the law governing guardianship and conservators. Section 11, on page 11, line 4, the attorney, in fact, is given the same immunity for actions taken in good faith pursuant to the power of attorney as physicians in this bill, and similar to the immunity that is provided to physicians in Senate Bill 20. This was also repeatedly raised during the testimony. Section 13 of the bill has been amended to prohibit the attorney, in fact, from interfering with health care providers in emergency situations. And Section 14 of the bill tracks in the same respects the crimes and penalties for forgery and alteration as those provided in Senate Bill 20. The only other point I wanted to make clear is that this bill, as I read it, the bills were joined for the purpose of hearing and testimony because they have concepts that related, but they do not, as of now, refer to each other, and this bill, action on this bill can be taken without effect on Senate Bill 20 and vice versa. That is, it stands or falls on its own merit.
Regarding the amendments, Dash 6, what's be open to comments or questions or discussion on those?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the amendments again for the same, and I don't know how interested you are in the bill. I just think for amendment purposes, I'd move them so we get it in check.
Senator Cohen moves the Dash 6 amendments. Discussion now.
Senator Waters. Making a Class A felony to Section 14. What kind of felony was it under the printed bill?
It was also a Class A felony, I believe. If in fact the, I'm not sure if the, it was also a Class A felony. And it also included the element that death of the principal be hastened.
Be what?
That the effect of it must be to hasten the death of the principal, the forgery or alteration of the power of attorney.
Do we have any current law in that area, or is it?
To my understanding, even without this language, one could be prosecuted under the murder statutes, but this makes some further law in the area. This section, however, tracks the crime and penalty sections of existing law under ORS 97 with regard to the forgery, revocation, alteration, destruction of directives. It is also a Class A felony under ORS 97 with respect to directives. The issue that's raised is the hastening of the death of the principal. I might add that both the forgery of a directive and the forgery of a power of attorney could be prosecuted under current forgery laws as a Class C felony without the additional elements of causing the withholding and hastening the death of the principal. That would be at the election of the prosecutor.
Is there any objection to these amendments? Are adopted. Does anyone have any other amendments to be suggested to Senate Bill 21?
It was part of the motion to adopt the amendments to have them printed like in 20, or is that?
I'm treating Senate Bill 21 as a I hope to dispose of Senate Bill 21 in this committee today. For some reason, showing why we need to delay it further.
Well,
Chair moves Senate Bill 21 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and I'll hear from discussion on that. Senator Cohen, what do you want to do?
Well, I'm not sure I'm prepared to move it today.
Okay, I put the motion on the table so we could discuss what to do with it.
Yeah, well, I'm.
What do folks want to do with this now that we've adopted these amendments? Do you want to just have the bill printed and bring it back later?
Sure.
Is that what you want to do? I will draw my motion then. And so the motion should be then to print the amendments -6 to Senate Bill 21. Is that?
Well, I made a motion to amend the bill.
Yeah, right. You
and,
did that.
That's do whatever. You want
all right,
to do
then the chair will move that the amendments as adopted be printed and Senate Bill 21 be engrossed to include these amendments. Is there any objection to that? The motion was to print an engrossed bill incorporating these amendments. Any objection to that? Okay, that's so ordered. Anything further on Senate Bill 21? Anything further, period? We're adjourned.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate President Kitzhoffer has asked that some testimony submitted in written form that the committee has be included in the record on Senate Bills 20 and 21.
Make sure you green flag.
Okay, thank you, members.
Doesn't read it word for word.